There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring. Right.
This podcast contains explicit content and is not suitable for all ages. Listener discretion is advised.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
My place in tech changes every day, but I don't fear the future because I'm with the leader, Pluralsight. Their online learning platform has the hands-on, expert-led courses I need to master new tech skills and create bigger impacts so I can learn quickly and stay ahead. With Pluralsight, I don't fear what's next. I embrace it. Tap in at Pluralsight.com and see for yourself.
Welcome back to Always the Last to Know. I'm Ash.
I'm her roommate, Katie.
What's going on, Katie?
Well, 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 here we are in Pennsylvania with Pete. Ash is moved in. We're ready to go. And it's very exciting.
Yeah.
You're even like having hangout bonding time with Mike. It's really fun.
We were up until 1:15 in the morning chit-chatting.
Just hanging out. It's so exciting.
Yeah. I mean, I came downstairs and he was like, you okay? And I'm like, yeah. And I went to go fill up my water bottle in the kitchen and I just started like crying while I was doing that. And when I went to walk back through the living room, he was like, do you want to just like sit and chat for a little bit? And I'm like, actually, yes. And then yeah, I started crying more. But it was really nice. It was very comforting. Very comforting. Thanks,
yeah,
Mike.
Yeah, it's cute. I love it. It makes me so happy to see my people becoming closer.
Aww.
Yeah, so like here we are recording in the same room really for the first time. I think we've like done this maybe two other times.
Yeah, yeah. But I think like when you were visiting or something.
Yeah, but this feels different.
It does. It does feel very different. We're hoping that the quality of this audio is up to par.
Mm-hmm.
Please forgive us if it takes us like one or two episodes to like really figure it out and make it sound really good. Just bear with us. It's a process. It's a learning process.
It's a learning process. This is basically like a whole new podcast, essentially, with like the whole different setup. We're doing everything differently.
Everything.
So yeah, bear with us, please. I don't have any updates or really anything to share. Do you have anything?
I mean, it's been just over a week now that I've been in Pennsylvania. I think the first few days were a little rough emotionally for me.
Understandable.
But I'm settling in and I feel comfy, cozy, and safe in my room and in this house. It's just an adjustment and gonna try to find a job soon. But it feels like, I don't know, the moving day was like kind of crazy.
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of a crazy day.
You can find us at Patreon, Always the Last to Know, by the way.
Moving day was a little insane. Definitely an experience. This is a whole new life experience for me.
Absolutely.
Walking away from a marriage and moving to a new state is quite a thing.
Have you ever moved out of state outside of boarding school?
Outside of boarding school? In college, no.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's different just because like college sets all that and boarding school like set all that shit up for us.
Yeah.
Whereas like when you're moving yourself, like it's you figure it out. So like this is a whole new process.
Yeah.
I hadn't really thought about that.
We certainly did figure it out. Well, I thought it was funny, too, because I remember texting you a few days before moving day and being like, my mom just texted me and was like, hey, I was looking up quotes for, like, moving people to come move the stuff, like, out of your apartment into the U-Haul. And I was like, while I appreciate the fact that you want to do this and the fact that you want to help me, I do want to do this in my own way. And knowing what I had to move myself, I was like, I don't. And she offered to pay for it, which is, again, thank you for the offer. Maybe just give me like gas money or something or food money. But I said to her, I was like, I appreciate that, but I want to do this my way. And I think that if I have other people in my space during what is a very emotional time for me, like strangers, I don't think that that is going to go well for me. And I'm not going to feel in this incredible moment of losing all control of everything in my life.
Yep.
Being able to control how things were moved out of my apartment that I had been in for 8 years was something that I desperately needed to have control of.
I love that you knew that and expressed it and was like, this is where I'm at, and I need it to be this way.
Yeah.
I love that. That's excellent. Good for you.
Thank you. And I didn't want her to feel like I wasn't grateful for the help or for the thought of it, because I am. I truly am. I understand that this was your way of trying to make this an easier experience for me.
For sure. But so Terry.
So Terry. And I love her for it. But I, in the last 6 months, have lost pretty much all control over what is like happening in my life. And I don't like losing control like that. So if that was one of the things that I could control, I'm going to control that.
For sure.
Yeah.
LOL. Can you put like elevator music?
I know, right? Side note, Ashley just died. Listen, You know what? Let's get real. Because of how stressed out I have been over the last several months because of literally everything, my divorce, the moving to a new state, the leaving my friends, leaving a job that I love, leaving the place I've known for 8 years. Like, I have been so stressed out. And honestly, I already have insomnia, but not sleeping well recently.
Here's the thing. Knowing you, the genocide. You know, so like you're like going onto your phone and you're like,
yeah.
Right.
Right. I also give a shit about the world and everyone in it. It, you know, it's crazy. It's like, I don't want to call everything I've been dealing with normal, but every bit of like normal life on top of like the shit state of the world, we're all stressed. And then like, this was wild shit that I've been dealing with. And I feel like my body was like, cool, we're super weak because like, you're not doing well mentally and emotionally, physically. I got sick. My parting gift from my ex was a sinus infection that I'm still dealing with. So I was just dying off. I was going to say off camera, but off mic, dying off mic for a minute.
I was also about to say off camera.
So like, let's just be real about that. I'm not okay. Mm-hmm. I haven't been okay. I mean, I'm doing better now that I'm like out of the environment that I was living in, where I felt like I couldn't really dive into my emotions and what I was feeling because I was trying to keep the peace in the apartment and I was trying to make sure that I could mentally handle helping families at work at the funeral home. Like they said, fake it till you make it, and I did.
Yeah.
Lights, camera, bitch, smile. And I did.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. It's been a weird time. This is definitely just going to be an adjustment. There have been good things. Just wrote a little love letter to my friends online because, like...
Yeah, that was cute.
You and everyone else, especially the crew in New Jersey, like, everyone has really carried me through the last 5 months and has truly, like, just shown me how much they give a shit about me and...
Years.
Yeah. Multiple years. But helping me pack and everything, that was crazy. Yeah. Helping me.
Jesse and Amanda.
So incredible. Just like so amazing. And like Lauren and Helen for supporting me throughout the last several months and being like, yes, bitch, live your fucking gay ass life. And we're mad that you're leaving, but we're happy for you.
Yeah.
So it's just going to be like a real adjustment period. But at least I'm with a safe person in a safe environment. environment.
And it's going to be okay.
Yeah. And you can figure it out.
If we're being honest, too, I know some of our patrons already know about this, but I have been dabbling into online dating. Hell yeah. And if I'm being honest, that part of the last several months has been the least complicated part of the last several months and has been a real comfort to me. So
it's really saying a lot.
Yeah.
Like, aren't there entire shows about people coming out and, like, trying to navigate their complex new dating life? Like, and you're just like, no, this is fine. I've got this.
Yeah.
It's everything else.
I was like, actually, this person is pretty fantastic and is making me not stressed when I'm with them.
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
That's new.
That's just know that I have had good things. I've got my yes. friends. And thank you, Miss Taylor Allison Swift.
Doctor.
Dr. Taylor Allison Swift. For choosing to release your brand new album on the day that I had already chosen as my moving day. By the way, I had picked April 19th first. She copied me.
Yes.
It also led to a very funny moment in the car. And I'm going to say that it's funny now that we're past it. But when So Long London played for the first time... And we were driving from Pennsylvania to New Jersey to go get the U-Haul. I started sobbing really hard in the passenger seat and Katie was driving. And the next thing I feel is Katie's hand awkwardly patting me on the back.
I don't know what to do in those moments.
No, you don't. And you're not a physical touch person no. where I am.
No.
And I, while sobbing, was just like, this is a lot for her. And I know she's trying so hard to comfort me. Trying so hard.
So hard.
And then I'm just sobbing over the lyrics to So Long London. So, but now it's funny. That's a funny moment. That's how we started the day. I was emotionally destroyed by Dr. Taylor Allison Swift.
Yeah. I mean, wowza.
Wow.
31 songs. I mean, just the process that went into writing and recording all of that.
The fact that we woke up to the double album announcement because we were like, we're not staying up till midnight. That's
no,
insane.
We can't do that.
We have to move
we
the
have
next
a whole
day.
Fucking move. Damn it.
I mean, what a day. But now we're here and we're on to a new chapter with a lot of things.
Yeah.
So this is going to be like an interesting transition time for all of us, I think.
Oh, definitely. Although I'm super excited. As I said last night, we're finally living my since college long dream where it's basically How I Met Your Mother, but I'm with Jason Segel, aka Mike, and shenanigans are going to ensue. Yeah. It's perfect.
You compared me to Hilary Duff in the new show.
Yeah. She's Hilary Duff. It's amazing. Like, this is so exciting.
We always talked about how we wanted to live on a commune together. And I was like, listen, we're not out in the middle of nowhere on a commune, but we're living together and we're making it work.
We're trying, okay?
Better than Purdell. You would last an hour in the asylum where they raised me. We did make a meme to that with our school's emblem.
Because Gen Z wouldn't. No.
Not that fucking place.
No, not at that time. No.
My God. The homophobia.
One bed, one girl.
They were like, you could actually just be friends and just be trying to like sit close enough to watch a movie on the same small computer screen.
Because we couldn't have TVs.
We couldn't have TVs. So we're trying to watch a movie on our computer, which is tiny back in the day.
It's DVDs. It's not streaming.
Yeah.
And like, we can't like get TVs. So yeah, you're just like literally trying to like watch a fucking movie with your friends, like the most normal teenage activity. And we couldn't even do that without being sexualized.
Mm-hmm. They're like, gay!
Yeah,
gay!
One girl, one bed. And one time, one of my friends, I think it was Paige. This is so Paige. Where she was like, so I could have sex with Allie on the floor, but we can't sit up here and watch a movie on the bed. And the teacher, Mr. T, was like, no, that's not, no.
Okay, sir.
We could all sit on the floor and like watch a movie, but we weren't allowed to sit on the bed, which is like so fucking dumb.
Yeah, which actually makes me laugh so much because the first time that I ever made out with a girl was on the floor in one of the quad rooms that she was in watching a movie on her laptop.
That's
so, like,
so funny.
Fuck you, Purdell.
Fucking got him.
Got him.
Oh my God, fucking Brunel, what a time. Oh shit, we're 20 minutes in.
I guess we can just get into it now.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit RightRug.com. RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Worried about your future in tech? Master new skills, accelerate your team's impact, and redefine what's possible with Pluralsight. We're more than just another online learning platform. We're shattering the skills gap and shaping future generations of technologists. Transform your work. Transform your team. Ready to tap in? Visit us at Pluralsight.com to learn more.
Episode 3, trigger warning. We are going to discuss eating disorders, childhood trauma, self-harm, suicidal ideation, and attempts, as well as some, like, kind of, like, fucked up opinions about those attempts. So we'll get to it.
I'm just, like, not at all surprised based on the current state of, like, the British tabloid media and it back then. Not surprised about, like, shitty commentary on people's mental health.
Yeah, I don't want to get too far into it, but weirdly enough, it's actually not the tabloids. It's author Tina Brown, who most, if not all, of these quotes are coming from, because I really dove into her chapter about, like, their first kind of few years of marriage. So that's mostly what we're going to be focusing on today.
Well, that is interesting.
I was really shocked, but we'll get there. We left off with Diana saying that by day 2, all of her hope was slashed. Yes. You can talk now. It's a conversation.
I can talk now. It's a conversation. Okay.
I know.
I just had, like, a very, I don't know, autistic, like, excited movement here. I realize that I'm not on camera anymore. But I just got so excited because I remembered how we ended the last episode. And then I got excited again because I remembered that you actually do have an answer for the question that you posed.
Because when I had originally read it, it was sort of just, like, listed amongst other things. But I found the full quote. I thought, you know, it was just grim. I had tremendous hope in me, which was slashed by day 2. We went to Broadlands second night. Out came the Vanderpost books he had read. Lawrence Vanderpost is a South African philosopher and adventurer who Prince Charles loves and fucking talks about all the time. 7 of them. They came on our honeymoon. He read them and we had to analyze them every day over lunch. End quote.
Not him giving her literary homework on their fucking honeymoon.
Absolutely. And this was, like, particularly painful because she was a little self-conscious about her lack of a full quote-unquote formal education, because remember, she dropped out. And then King Charles is, like, educated out the fucking asshole and, like, older and, like, thinks he's more sophisticated. So it's not even just, like, here's homework. It's, like, here's homework, you fucking idiot. Like, we have to talk about this over lunch. So it was the motherfucking books and the condescension that they represented.
I hate this man.
Isn't it disgusting?
Yes.
And I can't imagine, like, my newlywed husband spending the little time that we got together. Because remember, I said in the last episode, they're getting, like, barely any time alone where they don't have, like, these weird fucking events that they're scheduled for. And then him expecting me to, like, sit there and, like, analyze this philosophy that she's not at all interested in.
Yeah.
On their honeymoon. It's fucking condescending. Like, ugh.
Sorry to our British listeners, but condescension sounds like exactly what would come from a British king.
I mean, I think it's more the king than the British part.
Yeah, that's true. Okay, royalty in
general. Except for Wakanda.
Yeah.
All of their
obviously.
All of their royalty has been so chill. And this is, like, a reoccurring issue, not just through their honeymoon, but their entire relationship in general. He's constantly trying to educate her in this weird, like, highbrow way, to the fucking point where he mentions it in his biography when he's trying to talk to her about the philosophers he's interested in and, like, how she would just, like, look away. As Tina Brown said it, quote, "But from the moment the honeymoon began, it was as if she had woken in..." Wait, this is not...
Oh, I don't, damn it, I don't have the quote.
He was talking in his biography about how, like, he was trying to read to her from this philosopher he loved, and she would just, like, look away as if she was, like, this brat who was, like, disinterested in his interests.
Sir, did you even try to ask her about what she's into?
No, because remember, we talked about his upbringing. He doesn't have to ask people what they're into. That he talks about himself, always. He's the future king. So no, he didn't. And I don't think he would know to.
That's absolutely wild. I mean, that really plays into the mental aspect of what he's gone through and how it has really just stunted him emotionally.
Yes. I have a quote that touches on that later. Mm-hmm. Fucking chef's kiss. Love that you said that. So this is the world that Tina Brown was, that the quote that I was just getting into, and this is how kind of Diana was like looking in her life. Quote, from the moment the honeymoon began, it was as if she had woken at last from an insulin coma. During the engagement, her wish to preserve the delusion had become a willful not knowing. Her survival depended on its preservation. She had submerged herself so deeply in her escape scenario, she had refused to see the warning signals that now rushed in on her from every side. But the really terrifying dimension to her grief was the sudden, sharp understanding that all of the things that oppressed her during her engagement were now her life forever. End quote. She is 20 years old. It is like the darkest and most devastating way to like look into your future and see, quote, the oldness, the coldness, the deadness of royal life, its muffled misogyny, its whispering silence, its stifling social round confronting strangers. This is how it would be until she died. Nothing else can explain the violence of her panic. End quote.
You don't even know what you're like fully getting into until you're already in it.
No, no idea. And even if somehow someone sat her down and was like, this is exactly what you're getting into, your 19-year-old brain cannot understand. Your 20-year-old brain cannot understand. There's no fucking way.
You're not going to grasp the actual reality of the situation.
No. And she lives in this world completely alone. Because we touched on it in the previous episodes, but Charles has no idea what it's like to exist in a world outside of this. And I know this is all Tina Brown quotes and it's going to keep going, but this is so perfect. Quote, how could Prince Charles possibly understand? He had some glimmer of awfulness in his own existence, but he'd never known anything else. It had shaped him and made him who he was, a man who had never been young. End quote.
I know you read that to me last night, the other night while you were doing your notes, but that's still so impactful because you're absolutely right. How would he know to ask someone, hey, what are the things that you like?
Yeah.
Everyone has catered to him his entire life.
His everything. Everything. It's actually wild. So there's a moment at one point. I'm trying to see if I quote it later. There's a moment at one point where someone has a quote where it describes all of the things that are done for Charles. And it's a little bit of like Tina Brown's defense as to why the intertwining C cufflinks isn't necessarily all on Charles. But like the degree of stuff that is done for him, we are talking he wakes up and his toothbrush already has toothpaste on it.
Bananas. Absolutely bananas.
Everything is done
you
for him.
You like actually can't function, and it's almost like you're being babied throughout your whole life and you're an adult.
Yes.
It's like, God, just the mental and emotional labor that other people have been taking on, and physical, to cater to him just because he's supposed to be the next king. That's crazy.
Ashley, there was someone, Paul Burrell, who worked at Buckingham, who said that, quote, Burrell also revealed the detail that Michael Fawcett
later promoted to honored post, even held Charles' specimen bottle when a sample was required.
Stop. My God, bro. You're a dude. It's not that complicated to just hold it there. It is so much harder for vagina havers to fucking get into that little fucking cup. You know, if somebody would hold it for me, that would be great. But fuck you, because you can literally aim and see it in front of you. That's crazy.
Someone does that for him. So I'll read the full quote when it comes up, but like truly, truly, fully babied. He does nothing himself.
I think I would actually throw up if I were the one who had to do that. You couldn't pay me enough money to do that, especially for someone like the future king of England. Like, yeah. No thanks. I'm not trying to like hold a billionaire's pee.
No, thank you. There's one point where apparently Diana was kind of like making fun of Charles because they were learning something about King Henry and about how King Henry had like a bell that he would ring to have people come in and tell him the time. And Diana was like, oh my God, haha. Like, that's just like you. And King Charles was like, no, it's not. And she brought up the time where he was presented 3 shirt choices. He's like sitting like basically where I am right now. And he's presented 3 shirt choices and he doesn't like it. And his other shirt choices are where you are. And rather than get up and go grab a shirt choice, he literally like calls someone in to bring him a new shirt.
You actually have to be fucking kidding me. This is insane because like the effort and the extra time that it takes to call out to someone else, have them come in, give them the command, have them go do it. You could have just picked up the goddamn shirt already.
Yes, 100%.
Like, way to make your life way more complicated and take way more time to do simple tasks just because you want to be waited on. That's crazy.
Yeah, that's the kind of life that he is into. And I think that kind of adds a little bit into an understanding of why when Camilla kind of treated him like he was no big deal, that he like loved that. Because no one had ever done that before.
Yeah. A little freak.
Who knows?
I am not kink shaming.
No, of course not. But we are going to talk about sex for a second. Diana was like under the impression that they would get married and they would have like a romantic, passionate honeymoon. Then it kind of turned into, well, now that him and Camilla are not talking and we're on this ship, so he can't be with her, he will want me, which is so sad.
Sad. I'm also, he might throw up again just at the thought of him having sex.
That's fair.
But I'm sad for her that...
For 20-year-old her.
20-year-old her having these like expectations, not really knowing what the fuck is going to happen because no one actually prepared you for this. And you're stuck on a boat with this man who you are now married to.
Yeah. So we have a quote for some reason. The prince told a friend, quote, "The first night was nothing special. It was pleasant enough, of course, but she was really painfully naive."
Oh, she's 20.
She's 20.
You fucking asshole.
And didn't you like insist that she was a virgin?
Didn't y'all literally have a whole thing on the news where like her dad and her uncle were like, yeah, like,
we swear
she's a virgin. Like, ugh, how can you be mad at her for that then? Ugh, the condescension.
Isn't that fucking wild? So I couldn't quite get a timeline on this. And I think I can't remember where it was pointed out to me. Perhaps it was Tina Brown. Perhaps it was Sinisterhood or another podcast that I've heard about it. Do Princess Diana, but when Andrew Morton's first book came out in 1991-92, maybe that's when it was made. No, that's when it came out. Anyway, sorry, confused. When it first came out, the like libel and slander laws in the UK are like super strict. So even though Diana knew that Charles was having an affair with Camilla, they couldn't really straight up just say that in the book. I think a lot of stuff kind of gets like left out because of that. But he also has the transcripts of his conversations with Diana in the back. Now he has those because we'll get to it. So I couldn't find a direct timeline, but it did not take fucking long for Charles to be like craving Camilla and like trying to reach out to Camilla. Somewhere I saw that it was like the second day on the yacht, but I don't know that for certain. It's reported that he sent her like a long letter from the boat, but his valet, Stephen Barry, who comes up in a little bit, straight up said, quote, "The prince simply had to be in constant contact with Camilla or he couldn't function properly. If he went without his daily phone call, he would become tetchy and ill-tempered," end quote.
I truly wish people could see my face right now because I'm actually repulsed by this man. What a baby. I'm gonna have a temper tantrum if I can't talk to my mistress.
Abso-fucking-lutely. And this is the 80s. Like, it's not easy to call from a boat. This isn't like he's just like sending some fucking texts. Like, there's effort and money that is going into these phone calls from a yacht. Is that taxpayer money? I don't know how the UK works, but I'm not sure. But still, wild. Prince Charles, King Charles, I don't know, am I supposed to, whatever.
Charles?
Chuck. He is off, you know, like obsessed with Camilla, and it's hard for Diana. She has no one. It's supposed to be their honeymoon. She's expecting this like big romantic thing. It's not happening. Her bulimia is in full throttle, which is only feeling her lack of energy. And it's a cyclical, horrible time. And she has no one, not even the crew.
Really? Are they like told not to like interact with her or something?
Kind of, yeah. Crew member Philip Benjamin says the staff wore rubber-soled slippers so as to make no noise that might disturb the couple. Quote, "We were told to fade into the background. We were told to act like air." They're just like basically not supposed to exist.
Wow.
Yeah. So she would like try to talk to them.
Because she's such a nice person. I could totally, that's like me when I'm out with like wait staff and shit. I chit chat all the time.
Yes.
She absolutely is exactly that kind of person. Oh my God.
And they like can't really talk to her because they have rules. Because they're around all the time, they did see a lot. Philip Benjamin quotes this one time where he's talking about how he's like serving around the area. And there's a time where Diana like comes out of the royal suite in like kind of like cute, sexy negligee with a pink satin bow and is like, "Charles," like all teasy and sexy, being like, "Come here and do your duty," like really trying to engage her husband. And he just literally fucking sat there on his deck chair and read his philosophy book.
Actual audacity of this man. The actual audacity. She's such a catch.
Yeah.
Oh, she's only like 20. I'm sorry. I don't want to be weird about it. We all know she's so beautiful.
She's so cute. And like,
just imagine being that 20, super naive about like what's gonna happen, and that's not really your fault. You're actually trying to make a fucking effort, and all this man can think about is his bitch that's somewhere else, and you're like actually trying to make an effort. Like, that would hurt. 20 year old Ashley would have been so hurt, even if he is a gross fucker. I would have been so hurt.
Yeah, absolutely. For him to not even like come out and say anything too, I think that's what it is. I mean, 33-year-old Katie would be hurt if it was just completely ignored.
Like nothing.
It's devastating.
I actually definitely know what that's like right now. It's devastating. Okay, girl, can relate.
She's making attempts with Charles. She's trying to like make a bunch of friends, and slowly the sailors are like casually talking to her, but still not as much as she would like. Like, she is desperately just like, I need to not be fucking completely alone. It was noted by Tina Brown that Charles, quote, talked of his young wife like a grandfather about his teenage daughter. Diana dashes about, chatting up all the sailors and cooks in the galley, while I remain hermit-like on the veranda deck, sunk in pure joy with one of Lawrence Vanderpost's books, end quote.
I hate this man.
Right?
I'm up on the deck. I mean, you could just be, like, talking to her.
You could just have a fucking conversation.
Yeah. Like, oh my God. She clearly just needs some, like, human fucking interaction. That's so normal. I mean, he obviously doesn't understand that, but
it's said that she kept trying to come down to the crew, like, below deck parties and picnics, and that occasionally the kind of like security or like people who are supposed to be watching her found her playing piano to a room full of cheering sailors and were like, you need to get back upstairs. But she is like desperately trying to connect with people. And this is something that, as you said, like she's really a good-hearted person, like continues on through the rest of her life. Like she just wants to connect with other people because she is getting zero connection at home.
This particular conversation has me thinking about Meghan Markle and her conversations about the isolation that she experienced and the depression that she was experiencing, mm-hmm. and all of the extremes of it. And like, she is another person, so sweet, clearly just likes to be kind, chat with others. As a, that kind of a person myself, I cannot imagine how alone you must feel, how isolating this lifestyle is.
Yeah.
It's insane because it feels like this type of isolation goes against kind of like the norm of how I think society expects women to actually behave, like to be more of the social creatures.
Yes.
So I find it very interesting that the royal family would take that social norm and strip it away. That's wild.
Yeah, that's fair. That's a good point. This is where we get into the cuffling conversation. Did Charles even dress himself? No. Literally everything was picked out for him. This motherfucker did nothing, nothing, nothing. Brown writes, quote, the prince never chose his clothes himself. Ties, suits, shirts were always picked out every morning with cufflinks pre-inserted and offered to him like a choice of hors d'oeuvres by his faithful valet, Stephen Barry. At Buckingham Palace, Windsor, or Sandringham, his valet, opened his curtains in the morning and ran his bath. An orderly from the Welsh Guards arrived at dawn's light to shine his shoes. Even the prince's toothbrush was prepared pre-squeezed. According to Paul Burrell, a silver key bearing his feathers was attached to the end of the toothpaste tube with a sardine tin-like key. Would turn and squeeze just enough to fit on the brush. And he also revealed the quote that I said earlier about someone who had to hold the specimen bottle when a sample was required. So it actually kind of turns out that Barry, the valet, and Diana were bad beef, a little bit, clashing heads, because he was the one who picked out the clothes and the cufflinks. And quite a few sources said that Barry felt a little replaced by Diana.
That's actually so wild to me because of how isolated she is. Like, replaced how? Sir, he doesn't even like her. How are you being replaced?
These are excellent questions. So when the prince first bought where he lived, Highgrove, quote, Barry had spent bachelor weekends with Charles, setting the place up and helping him paint pictures. Now there was a moody and possessive young wife to deal with, who did such unlovable things as replacing the formal lace-ups Barry always ordered, handmade from John Lobb of St. James, with unpricely off-the-rack loafers, and picking out sweaters for him to wear in overly fashionable pastel colors the prince actually seemed to like. Diana never trusted Barry. She found him too familiar with Charles. She actively resented him from the moment he had refused her access to the Prince of Wales' room in Buckingham Palace during the engagement. HRH says no one is allowed in, Lady Diana. I'm sorry, but orders are orders. I hope you understand. She didn't, and gradually started to freeze him out, end quote.
Wow, what things to be butthurt about. Are you in love with King Charles, sir?
Oh, I mean, maybe.
I mean, it's giving that possessive vibe, yeah. Honestly.
Yeah, people are obsessed with their proximity to the king.
Yes, I mean, that makes sense. With that status and that closeness, you gain a little bit more power.
Absolutely, like you're the one who does everything for the king. That's invaluable.
His life is in your hands.
Yeah, he needs you. That's, you know, that's a weird proximity to power. He probably didn't want to give up, allegedly. So the honeymoon ends at Balmoral, their Scottish castle, because as per his yearly schedule, Charles spends 6 weeks there every year from August to like early October. And it like actually sounds like a fucking nightmare.
I'm a little disappointed to hear because Scotland is amazing.
Oh, yeah. It's not the problem. The problem is not Scotland. It's how the royals treat their vacation, quote unquote.
Okay. Tell me more.
Tina Brown. When it wasn't a forced march to a familial picnic barbecued by Prince Philip, it was a formal dinner with the Queen and whichever august elderly visitors happened to be in Her Majesty's party. Prince Charles was used to it, always ready in a kilt, jacket and frothing jabot 10 minutes before they had to leave for the cocktail hour, but Diana was not. Balmoral etiquette required that she did not sit next to Charles. She had to take her place between a couple of courtly fogies and listen for 2 to 3 hours to the booming of Prince Philip about the evils of trade unions or Princess Anne barking about her day's bag. Guests had to stay seated until the Queen's bagpipes wheezing traditional Scottish airs finished parading around the table and signaled that the women had to leave the men to their port and cigars. Getaways could not be made until after the Queen's exit allowed them, which was usually a little before midnight, though they could be trapped till 2 a.m. listening to Princess Margaret play old show tunes on the piano, end quote.
I hate every part of that. Mm-hmm. Every part of that sounds like a nightmare.
Remember the episode where I talked about how they only had to change 4 times a day?
Yes.
That's this place.
Oh, boy. They were like, oh, you're on vacation.
Yes.
We'll take it easy with the costume changes.
Keep it cash. And it's not like you can just, like, walk around. You can't just, like, go outside for a walk because the queen might be outside and she might want it to themselves. So you have to, like, send a letter to the queen's person and everything is, like, so weird and so formal and, like, no one understands what the, like, Diana is looking at all of this and being like, am I fucking crazy or is this crazy?
Like, what planet was I transported to?
What the fuck is going on? I'm 20. I am not legally allowed to drink alcohol in the United States. I'm so young. People are noticing that she's not happy, but not in, like, a cool way at first. Quote, a dinner guest recounts how the queen cornered him one night, Charles, and exploded. Look at her sitting at the table glowering at us. The only time she bucks up is when Charles speaks to her. The guest replied, perhaps if you look around the table, ma'am, they're all so much older than her. She said, I don't care. She'll just have to buck up. End quote.
Wow. Be a bitch.
Right?
You're a woman who went through this same kind of lifestyle. What happened to you to make you so unempathetic? Never. I mean, we know. We know.
Remember, she's the person who shook her little boy's hand when she came back. Like, she was raised for this.
Yeah.
This horrible life. Yeah. She's basically stuck in Balmoral alone, feeling completely out of place, which is a written in a letter that she wrote to one of her old flatmates. Quote, sometimes I wonder what on earth I've gotten myself into. I feel so small, so lonely, so out of my depth. Her and Charles are fighting like fucking crazy. Her bulimia is not necessarily like an exact source of the argument, but a definite source of tension. She's rapidly losing weight. She is not healthy because that's the only thing that she feels like she can control in this environment. And he and Diana are fighting a lot, a lot. A palace official says that there was one day where he could hear the prince and princess having a huge fight. Quote, the door burst open and Charles appeared looking thunderous. Michael, he said, and threw something gold at him. It was Diana's Welsh gold wedding ring the British people had so recently seen placed tenderly on her third finger before the Archbishop of Canterbury. Get it made smaller, the Prince of Wales said. End quote.
Damn, bro. Relax.
Yeah, they're fighting a lot and it's really not going great at Balmoral. By the end of their trip, things are beyond bad. Her bulimia is severe. Her depression has spiked to an all-time high. She's 5'10 and weighs 126 pounds.
Oh my God.
And it got so bad that Charles actually started reaching out to people asking for help and was like, can you just get like your wife to come here and just like sit and talk to her? she didn't want to call her friends because she was too embarrassed of like what she had gotten herself into and like what she looked like and just sort of everything. So she ended up asking for a secretary who had previously worked with her and who worked for Charles. Mr. Colburn had expected to stay with the princess for just a couple of hours, but ended up being there 4/7.
Wow.
Listening pretty much in silence to a clock just ticking on a wall where Diana was either sitting with her head bowed or raging, just like visibly raging about her feelings and everything.
Yeah.
When Colburn and Charles got a moment to talk, this is what he had to say. Quote, Charles started to vent about, all things, the carpets that had been installed against his wishes in the new Range Rover.
Are you fucking kidding me?
He minded that when he slung the deer he'd shot in the back of the car, it left blood all over the mat. The betrayed royal servant, who had already informed the prince that the mats had pressed studs for removal for just this purpose, was nursing his hurt feelings on the train when the prince summoned him to his private carriage. He offered Colburn a drink. Tonight, Michael, he said, you have displayed the best traditions of silent service. You didn't say a word. He then proceeded to reward Colburn by dumping his problems on him all over again. For 5 hours.
Oh,
the prince ruminated aloud about Diana's baffling dislike of country pursuits, her possessive need to be in his company at all time, and her lack of any sustaining hobbies. End quote.
What? What? You think she's gonna have the emotional bandwidth and mental bandwidth to have a fucking hobby when you've been treating her the way that you have for months? Wow. Okay.
Noted in so many sources, the royals are like notoriously suspicious of psychiatric interventions and sometimes just like doctors in general. Like people, they're just worried about bringing people into their circle, but specifically psychiatric interventions, not chill with. But it gets so bad that Charles ends up taking Diana to London to get professional help.
Thank God, because she needs it.
She is fueled and consumed with Camilla and the affair. But it's painted as like paranoia almost, when it's actually like one of the most reasonable anxieties that Diana had at the time. And it really doesn't help that during all of this, Diana is one of the most beloved people, rapidly becoming probably the most beloved of her time. And that's something that Charles clocks right away. He could not hide his jealousy of Diana's attention. Not because he didn't like them like looking at her out of a weird ownership, but rather because he wanted the attention himself.
He's so used to having all eyes on him all the time. He's like, how can I share this spotlight? This is supposed to be for me.
Absolutely. That's like so fucking on point. And one of the things that I love that Tina Brown did was she compared Charles with JFK.
Okay.
And talked about how they both grew up in, you know, sort of the American royals is what they called them.
Yes.
Like everyone loved the Kennedys and was obsessed. And they were both growing into power. But JFK was more aware of image. You know, we talked about it in the JFK episodes. Like they were trained to be aware of that. Whereas the royal family has this like secret deal where they're kind of like relying on the press to be chill, which in 2024 eyes is like the fucking craziest shit that I've ever heard. Like trying to have a deal with the press.
That feels like something out of a comic book movie or something.
Yes. So when Tina Brown's talking, she's like talking about how JFK like understands how to use what is around him and what's going on around him to his benefit and to twist it. Something that Diana clearly understands, but Charles is just not good at it. They have a trip to Wales, and it's sort of, they call it a royal walkabout, which I guess is that that's when they're all walking through the streets.
Are we talking like, remember the scene in Princess Diaries? I think maybe the second one where Princess Diaries 2, where she's in Genova and they're like in the car and everybody's kind of parading through the streets of the town and she's stopping and talking to everyone and like sees the little group of kids, that kind of a shit.
It's kind of like that, but they're not in a car.
Okay.
They're walking through the streets like a parade, essentially. And she is shaking hands with people. She's getting down on one knee to chat with little kids. She's holding babies, specifically babies, it like specifically referenced babies with spina bifida. She spent time learning Welsh, specifically like the phrase thank you and like common courtesies, so that when she was talking to the Welsh, she could speak their language. Charles didn't speak Welsh.
Yeah. She's putting in the effort to be a better communicator, and that's what humans like.
Absolutely. And one of my favorite quotes that just like, quote, with Diana, it was all heart all the time, end quote.
She's just genuinely a good person.
Yeah.
And that's why people like her.
Exactly. People on her side of the street that she was walking on got so excited. And people on the Charles side of the street were like bummed. So they were like calling like, Diana, Diana, like over here. And getting like, ooh, ah, when she would do that. So, you know, with one side really excited, Charles was like, well, I want to go to the excited side. So he tried to switch sides and the crowd was not happy. Quote, every time this happened, you had this huge ah from the people whose side she was leaving. All the time, people kept calling, die, 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 to try and get her to come to their side. It would be really embarrassing, British photographer Jane Fincher said. On the other side of the road, they'd all be going, oh no, just because they'd got him. And he'd just turn around and say, I'm really sorry, she'll be here in a minute. When they, like, approached an expectant village, the people yelled, there she is, not there they are. A palace official noted, King Charles kicking a pebble around. The prince told him, they don't want to see me. He was wobbly, end quote.
I actually can't. Oh, it's my God.
33.
Woe is me. She has an actual personality and is a nice person, so they like her more. Oh.
They don't want to hang out with me.
Nobody likes me.
The next line in Tina Brown's book even goes on to talk about, like, all of the times that Diana was resting and Charles would, like, go about Wales delivering speeches, as if framing Charles was speeches that were like planned for this trip as like filling in time while she rests. Like, people just wanted Diana, and the coverage and press for his speeches without her was nothing. It was so bad. And Charles was pissed that the people loved his wife. And Diana was really shocked that he was upset about it. She thought, like, oh my God, I'm doing such a good job.
Isn't this the whole point of you getting married to her? Didn't you want a very specific type of woman to be your wife?
Yeah.
One who could do well in social situations? One who would be a good face for the royal family? Is that not exactly what you looked for? And then you're mad when you get it.
Yeah.
And resentful.
Exactly.
Wow.
Exactly.
Unpack that in therapy, Charles. You really need to.
Truly. Quote, Diana couldn't understand why nobody said, well done, recalled a former palace aide. The reason is that they all do their duty and wonder what's so unique, like, about her doing it. They wondered, all right. She told James Coulters that she, quote, really got it in the neck from Charles after the Wales tour. She was so excited for every reason that you just said. And he was so mean. It's during this tour of Wales that this infamous photo, which is labeled as the sleeping princess, gets taken and released. And I'm going to send this to you. We'll post it on Instagram. She is at a ball. It's a day after she's been on display walking around. Her bulimia is in full swing and Diana falls asleep at an event.
I just wish somebody had had her back.
I know. In order to explain it, the two announce news that they had actually been holding on to for a little while. She was pregnant.
Was she really?
She was. Okay. That's not at all why.
Yeah. Oh my God, no. But not at all.
She was. Everyone was so excited. According to Diana, her true story in her own words, the couple scheduled the birth of their oldest son around Charles' polo schedule. Quote, when we had William, we had to find a date in the diary, their planner, that suited Charles and his polo, Princess Diana told biographer Andrew Morton. I will say that Tina has a different perspective that comes up a little bit later during the birth. So we will get to that. But she points out that these conversations that Diana is having for this biography are post-divorce. Mm. So there might perchance be a bitterness and extra harshness looking back. And she kind of re-examines a little bit of Diana's story during the birth. So we will get to that. But this was a really difficult fucking pregnancy on Diana, maybe because she was feeling unloved, incredibly stressed, and was severely bulimic. What do I know? She kept canceling different appearances and just like wanting to just like stay home and sleep all day. For some reason, the home that they were supposed to live in Kensington Palace, was not ready after they got back from their honeymoon. So they ended up having to stay in Buckingham Palace, which was like his bachelor pad that he was living in. But it's really like Diana hated it because you're essentially just like living in the orbit of the queen. It's not at all what she wanted for her like living with Charles for the first time. So she's not feeling good in her space. And that lasts for a little while. And it's not until they move into their apartment in Kensington Palace that she really starts to get a sense of self and like takes a lot of joy in decorating it and like nesting and has a lot more privacy. She picked a designer, which was not the one that people expected her to pick, a little bit outside the norm. And Charles didn't super love that designer's work. But then rather than being like a little bitch about it, he like worked with it, it seems. So he took sort of the vibe of furniture that went with the room, and rather than doing what the guy would have ordered, he brought in like similar collection pieces from the royal collection. And it sounds like they made their home at Kensington Palace like an actual little home for the two of them that really was a nice blend.
I'm honestly so shocked by this.
Because there were small moments where the two really connected. There's this often cited moment where I think it's during the Wales trip where they're sitting together and someone is playing the national anthem and Charles, like one of them just like kind of like leans over. I think it was Charles like leans over and is like, look, love, like they're playing our song, like being funny. And the two of them are like giggling together and connecting. And the queen is pissed.
Oh boy.
It's inappropriate behavior. So then that stops immediately.
Inappropriate behavior to giggle with your husband.
During the national anthem because they're royalty. But still, like it could have been a cute moment if they had told the public, like, this is our song, like, because it is.
If they spun it in the press, because they have control over them already, it's a symbiotic relationship, like, had they told them, hey, play it off as us having a cute moment together, like, it could have worked out for them.
Because it was a cute moment. It could have also
probably raised his popularity a little bit by showing a human side of him.
Absolutely. Because that's the thing, like, as much as he is a little bitch, he does have his moments for his very limited ability to be a person. Diana's trying so fucking hard. Her designer, like who did a lot of the clothes and put together a lot of the outfits that she wore to the polo matches, quote, no matter what you were making for her, the question was always, will my husband think I'm sexy in this, end quote. Like, she wanted this to work. And it's so heartbreaking.
It just feels like tale as old as time. The woman just trying to make the relationship work, doing the most and getting nothing in return. And it's so sad.
It's really devastating, especially when you think about the way that the world is like looking at and talking about their relationship. It's supposed to be like this dream romance, prince and princess. Brown writes, Charles' sexual interest in Diana decreased in the exact ratio to how much more desirable she became to the world. End quote. Many things are pulling them apart. And Diana is like the one thing that's like, she's trying so fucking hard. She will also admit that at this time specifically between her bulimia and the pregnancy hormones, she was not easy to be around. Very small things like set her off. Some things understandable because it had to do with the affair. Other things it's like, okay, pregnancy meets depression and bulimia. Oh no. Quote, the fight between Diana and Charles when they retired for one night got so ugly that an antique mirror was shattered, an 18th century chair leg damaged, and a pane of glass in the window broken. There was another blow up that same month during a pheasant shoot when Diana tried to stop Charles from going out with the guns. 11 years later, she told Andrew Morton that she threw herself down a staircase after in a suicide attempt. But this was just material from her internal postmarital rewrite desk. The last thing she ever would have done was hurt her unborn child. One of Diana's aides at the time told me that she remembers Diana saying, very embarrassing, I slipped down the stairs and landed at Queen Mother's feet. I saw the gynecologist, but he said, you'll be fine. Stop worrying. End quote.
Okay, it's like, which one do you believe?
Yeah.
The worker from the palace who probably has some type of NDA to stick to, or Diana herself, who is the more reliable narrator here?
I'm never going to be one to be like, if you see that as a suicide attempt, then you see that as a suicide attempt.
Yeah.
It's a narrative I really don't like. And it continues. Quote, the version of the story she gave to Andrew Morton, Prince Charles was supposed to have gone straight out riding after the incident. And when he came back, it was, she told Andrew, just dismissal, total dismissal. Bollocks to that, as Diana would say. A member of the staff who witnessed the scene told James Whittaker and Prince Charles had been desperately concerned when Diana took her tumble, and that it was him who called the doctor. Far from going out riding, the prince stayed with his shaken wife for the day and took her out to a picnic lunch at the royal family's beach house on the coast near Wells next to the sea, end quote. I really, like, dislike the narrative that she is saying that she's only calling it a suicide attempt because she wanted it to be shocking and wanted it to sound worse, when in reality, we have no idea how bad she thought it was, like how bad she was at the time. And I understand maybe it's like easier for people to digest that, like, it's not a suicide attempt. She's rewriting it. She would never have, you know, wanted to kill herself and, you know, what was going to be her son. But like, we don't actually know that.
Yeah, we don't. I mean, you have Meghan Markle, who is getting like similar treatment, talking about how while she was pregnant, she wanted to kill herself because of the isolation and the things that they were doing to her and the racism that she was experiencing.
Yes.
Like, very much could be so that she would attempt that.
Absolutely.
There is a real possibility, but absolutely, we don't know. And we never will.
No. The only real, like, data that we have is a score that Diana took for the social readjustment rating scale. She scored an alarming 408, where the scale itself says that a 150 to a 299, like, scale could lead to mental illness. There is data that says that her stress chart changes, like, include marriage, pregnancy, career changes, change in work responsibility, personal achievements, change in living conditions, revision of personal habits, some of the most stressful events that we would expect to see any level of stress or potential mental illness popping out in, like, regular people. The idea that, like, she's just being dramatic, I don't like that, but I wanted to note that that is a kind of a story, I guess, that people are saying. And I do have this other moment of them really connecting. In February of 1982, they fly to the Bahamas, which ends up being like a second honeymoon, but real honeymoon. They're staying at the Windermere, the home of the Lord and Lady, in this like elegant but simple, secluded spot, which was like a million times more romantic than anything they had ever done before. And they were actually able to do like real couple shit for the first time. They would like take turn grilling. They water skied and windsurfed and like sunbathed together. They were seen swimming, like cuddling and kissing each other and like really like enjoying each other's company in privacy, because the press actually had to like do some like sketchy stuff to get these images in a way that the queen was really, really pissed about, because it was not things that they did before. But people were so obsessed with Diana that they like had to see it. So there are these moments where like, if all of this stuff, you know, if Camilla didn't exist and they weren't the royal family and they were just two people who could have connected, like, could it have been different? Maybe. It wasn't all horrible. The birth of William is June 21st, 1982, which is almost exactly a year of marriage in. Like, that's so fast. The Queen's first comment when she saw her new grandson, Prince William, was, "Thank heavens he hasn't got his father's ears."
Are you fucking kidding me? Not you insulting literally your offspring.
Your child.
Bitch, you gave him those ears.
You did that. So, you know, I mentioned earlier, Diana was telling Morton that William's birth had been induced, like had been scheduled because around his polo calendar. Tina is saying like that it was induced to fit, like she had an induced birth to fit with the calendar. But Tina wonders if this is sort of like another rewrite and not an actual reflection of the moments. Quote, "The prince was present throughout all 16 hours of Diana's difficult labor, a most un-Windsor thing to do. That is not something that the royal family did. In fact, he was the first ever Prince of Wales to be in the room when his wife gave birth. Charles sounded like any besotted new dad when he wrote to Patricia Mountbatten, like a close family friend, quote, "The arrival of our small son has been an astonishing experience and one that has meant more to me than I ever could have managed. I am so thankful I was beside Diana's bed the whole time, because I really felt as though I deeply shared in the process of the birth, and as a result was rewarded by seeing a small creature which belonged to us, even though he seemed to belong to everyone else as well," end quote.
He had a little bit of an introspective moment.
He's trying. He has these moments of like clarity. I talked about that last time where he had that moment where he was like, "I can't live with someone for 2 years. Like, I have to make the right call. Otherwise, you guys are going to jump down my throat about it." He has some self-reflection there, and he was thrilled when William was born. And that clashes a little bit with the way that Diana talked about how that day went. And I do wonder what she would say now, had she had the time to kind of unpack everything a little bit. But noting the time of year, it was June, meaning that the yearly Balmoral 6 week is rapidly approaching. And we know how bad it was last time. It was almost deadly for Diana. At one point there, she went for 3 nights without sleeping, spending most of the time locked in the bathroom, throwing up after a bulimic junk food binge. It was here that she overheard Charles in the bath on the phone with Camilla, saying, no matter what happens, I'll always love you. She's seeing counselors, but they're never going to be able to help her because she's not telling them about her bulimia. At this time, one of the only, like, real friends in her world that she had known, Princess Grace, passed away from injuries in a car crash, which is wild. And Diana wanted to go to her funeral, but women don't go to funerals. So Charles was supposed to go. Charles didn't want to go. And Diana actually ended up stepping over the head of Charles and the queen, like going to Sir Philip Moore, the sovereign herself, who decided in the end that since no one else wanted to go, Diana can go.
Damn, let me go to my friend's fucking funeral. Right? Shit.
And it's actions like these that the public just love. They're seeing her break really fucking stupid traditions with heart and with reason and importance.
Like, of course the public is like, oh my God, yes, let her go to her friend's funeral. Like, that's such a normal thing to do.
It really, really is. So, you know, they're having these moments of connecting and she's still sort of just like being her Diana self. And then they go off on a 6-week tour of Australia and New Zealand in March of 1983. And this is where we start seeing the international appeal of Princess Diana. And next week, we're going to dive into really, truly, madly, deeply the downfall and divorce. I promise. Sorry, guys. I got really invested in these 2 years. But I had told Ash I would keep this short because we're experimenting with recording in person. But then this ended up being 10.5 pages. So I'm going to cut it here.
We are at the hour and 30 minute mark.
Yeah, going to cut it here. and we will dive in next week after I finish my finals to the rest of Diana's life. I promise.
We'll see you next week. Bye.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit RightRug.com. RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring. Right.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
For any photos related to today's episode, please go to our Instagram.
You can follow us on Instagram and TikTok at AL2KPodcast.
Like us on Facebook at Always the Last to Know Podcast.
If you have any questions, please email us at AL2KPodcast@gmail.com.
Please share, rate, and review us on your podcast listening app of choice.
Join our Patreon. You can find us at patreon.com/AL2KPodcast or click the link in our bio on social media.
Thanks for listening.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit RightRug.com. RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring. Right here, right
now. At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.